当特别样的吃肉的扛了吃不吃吃那三件事跟军事呢他的就苏苗亚的肯定也是了对军部是原来跟军的三件事样的本来的的我们朝浪给他们跟军拿了三毛的丢吧是你丢吧是要吃什么去第一卡的时候是那么一呢三面几乎三级什么的刚才是浪到个那这么的落没呗他几乎三面几乎的就没办法去我妈的意思没准备就得去我妈的大概就得去我妈的准备就得去我的意思准备就卡的时候呢然后呢这个这个偏不的设备突击全部宁日成不了呀那你两年哪呢谈了谈呢这在现在主要的那你这个招不送手啊当然是大东西的事实不是这段这个这个三件事吧这是他的论呢那你人就了呀那你帮到委员的他妈就了解这样帮到委员的这狂人狂都配合他呢他的呢现在的他的是不是主要的全部的意思呢就是不要的这这一段呢三界是要自己的阿姨捐给是原来跟那个帮到早百三界的七娘是让我的在那中文一般的等着这边三界的因为到过人机去的起初起头的心因为呀三界的心就是呢罗边那个就用不了的因为罗边那个可能呀因为罗边金军是要的因为捐给是原来跟那差身边那个里呀因为三界跑过来呀没罗边金军是要的让到那就去的，去掉了点呢，都写的，但康萨斯那边都几乎掉了南西的，落不得没落的泥。但点不起的，除了我的钱就在呢，他妈的你超过住一点的钱，第一千块高了，掉了点呢，哎呢，他妈弄个缺高了，第一些粮食烂呢，哎呢，这些就要倒卖吃的，哎呢，倒卖原来是卖给呢，这个电报公司都谈呢。也是就是建议的呢，那让军队去干啥？进军了就是，我都是呢，那三界去进军先，从容下来呢，那都是的，这么一来，我今天印度人不如的，三界去进军先呢，都送的多啊，我都当然都是一来，这啊都是。
In the verse of salutation of this text, the object of homage.Was identified as the Buddha, the Dharma and Sangha, the Buddha, the teachings and the spiritual community. So these are the three objects of refuge. And in Buddhism, they are known as the three jewels. The first is the Buddha, who is defined as a being who had attained total perfection of all realizations and knowledge, and also total elimination of all the defects.And limitations and afflictions of mind and soul. So how do we understand such a fully enlightened being? How do we understand the characteristics of such a fully enlightened being? In this respect, it is helpful to reflect upon a verse written by the Indian master Dignag, where he, in his text on Compendium on.Valid cognitions, he pays homage to the Buddha by pointing out that you who have become a valid being. So this, the operative word, the key word here is the word becoming. The point being made here is that the fully enlightened Buddha, the teacher, was not an eternally enlightened being, but rather someone who has become a valid teacher, someone who has become a fully enlightened. So this word becoming,has a very significant point, which is that the Buddhahood do not come about from no cause. Buddhahood comes about from causes, and also that it doesn't come about from causes that are completely discordant with the result. So in other words, that the causes are themselves not permanent, and enlightenment comes about from a cause,And it also comes about from causes that are incommensurate with the results. And then Dignaga identifies what is that key cause for attaining Buddhahood. And here, cultivation of compassion, the universal compassion, the great compassion, is identified as the key factor, the key cause. So in the salutation to the Buddha made by Dignaga, he pays homage to the Buddha as someone who has become a valid teacher, a valid being, an authentic being, through the practice of, sustained practice of compassion. So what we see here is that the fully enlightened being had attained that state of enlightenment as a result of a sustained and prolonged practice of compassion, and also some of the other associated aspects of the path, such as the wisdom realizing emptiness and so on. So the key here is the realizations that the Buddha has attained, which is the true Dharma, and it is on the basis of the realization of the Dharma we define Sangha and the Buddha, because those who are still on the path and had attained the path of seeing and had gained direct insight into the ultimate nature of reality, they are the Sangha, true Sanghas. And once you proceed in this path and attain a total culmination of this realization, that is the state when you have attained Buddhahood. So it is on the basis of the Dharma that the other two jewels, the jewel of Sangha and the jewel of Buddha, are also defined. So this is how we need to understand the nature and characteristics of the Buddha, fully enlightened Buddha, on the basis of understanding the nature and characteristics of the true Dharma. In terms of chronology of a particular era, then there is a sequence between the three in terms of evolution. For example, in the case of the present Buddha, Buddha Shakyamuni, in terms of evolution of the teachings of that Buddha, first the Buddha Shakyamuni came as a Nirmanakaya, emanation Buddha, and then Buddha then taught the teachings. Initially, the teaching was at the level of scriptural texts. Therefore, you have the scriptures that were taught by the Buddha. And then, on the basis of the scriptures taught by the Buddha, his disciples engaged in the practice and cultivated the realizations of these scriptures, thus evolved the Dharma as realization. And then, those who have gained realizations of the Arya stage, the path of seeing, those became the Sangha. So within the context of a single era, you can say the Buddha comes first, Dharma comes second, and then Sangha evolves third. Because of this, the order in which we go for refuge or pay homage to the three jewels is always Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha.
Da sangye di chig memba da dawa. Ani nai le da ngus buge da kato da tawa chenye di chue yi zanye, chue di memba da dawa. Ani chue di chu shing yang su lingye ge, ani tawa gindun di nai ha da dawa chenye, odi li shegi bari. Da dun yang ni dungye le ngus buge da gyo da chenye di chue yi bari. Sa dindri yin du chue di gyo ngus ya ge.
So it's because of this we find in the text when referring to these three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, often the metaphor of medicine is used. And so the Buddha is likened to a physician, and the Dharma, the teachings, is likened to the medicine, and the spiritual community, the Sangha, is compared to a sick nurse and the one who helps and looks after the patient. So what we understand from this analogy is that it is in fact the Dharma, which is the true medicine, that directly counters the illness, the ailment. And it is the Buddha who prescribes the medicine of Dharma, and the one's colleagues, companions on the path they who are the Sangha members, who act as a support while you are going through this process of therapy. Therefore, often the three jewels are referred to as Buddha as the true teacher, Dharma as the revealed teaching, and Sangha as companions who support you in your practice.
칠로 사장 소로 나와도 몇 소로 지기 견다 다 세미나로 견다 지야 요마로와 다 세미 견다 가르서는 미국 지금 미네 남바 게 때는 진단 게 와치니 다 세미 겨알림으로 와다 데이터네 다 말 속고야기 시베지 그르그르 여자가 대다 게 진단 게 와인 등에 시바 그르그르 여자 디디 다 자주다니 디시마체 다 데이터네 빼는가도 계시되는 콩부변은 슉슉을 담고 죽나? 인식을 깨는데, 잠발을 깨는데, 봐, 대기한다. 아니, 지금 이 밑이 콩에 고도 빼기 있나? 콩도 슉슉슉을 아직 빼지, 욕을 하자. 봐야. 다 니가 가서 가서 누구야, 아니면 펭귀야, 말해. 자, 다 니가 콩을 믿으셔. 지금 잠발하고, 쌤을 깨면 있나? 롤리하고 슉슉을 심으면 있나? 그 쌤이야, 별로를 척이야. 그 쌤 깨면 있구나. 자, 니네 이마 있는데 잠발을 랑절해. 잠수대 랑절해. 나 대미든 쇼하디. 랑은 누구에 인자 터져래. 와, 니네 이마 있는데 다 간다디. 콩주 견다. 콩주슬럼니. 니버 때문에 지다. 심지어도 슬럼 뭐 이마 강요롱어 지도 민네. 다 텔레야 지금 쌤 쭈무로 이래라. 지금 이마 인자네. 대 떵다디. 유 텔레 민네. 지금 쟤와. 유 텔레 민네. 지금. 대화 중나 삼바 때 유태라베 집 가서 태바 중나 삼베 잠신들이 곧들려야 그니 가서 우리 따당을 겨울에도 와 어디 상제의 식으로 나니 간다 생각나게 겨울제니 겨울제니 고야디 당도랑 디식으로 칠치면 그도로 이니 먹어야디 그 갈래갈래 식으로 나지 너단 데려도 와
So the question is, then what exactly is this Dharma jewel which defines the other two jewels, the Buddha and Sangha? What are its characteristics? How can we cultivate that within us? Here we have to understand, as I mentioned earlier, when we speak of the Dharma jewel in the context of Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, the true Dharma really refers to the true cessation, which is the third noble truth. And cessation here refers to the freedom that an individual gains as a result of applying the antidotes against afflictive emotions and thoughts, those negative aspects of the mind. As a result of applying their corresponding antidotes, when one gains a kind of a freedom that ensures, that prevents their future arising, that is called the cessation. And those cessations can be of many different levels. And that is the true Dharma. And also the path that leads to that cessation is also the true Dharma. So the true Dharma here refers to the third noble truth, the truth of cessation, and the fourth noble truth, the truth of the path. Now the question is, if true Dharma refers to the cessation of the negative aspects of the mind, afflictions of thought and emotions, then the question is, what is the process, or what is the procedure, or what is the mechanism of bringing about such cessation? How can one cultivate the antidotes? How does the antidote work in bringing about the cessation of these negative aspects of our mind? Here, one has to understand that in according to Buddhism, of course, our very existence as conditioned existence itself is understood to be characterized by suffering. It is referred to as, in fact, the pervasive suffering of conditioning.
Present existence.
Yes. Our present existence as a conditioned being is understood to be suffering. This is the third level of suffering, the suffering of pervasive conditioning. So, in this sense, yes, including our physical embodiment, our physical body is, in a sense, in the nature of suffering, something that needs to be ultimately gotten rid of, something that needs to be ultimately eliminated. But in Buddhism, when we speak of our very existence as suffering, we're not implying that the mere physical existence or mere bodily existence is suffering. For example, from the Buddhist point of view, even the Buddha Shakyamuni is seen as an embodied being however, Buddha Shakyamuni is free of suffering, and also the arahats who have gained freedom from negative emotions and thoughts, they also have the aggregates, the skandhas. So what is being referred to as suffering is this conditioned existence, present existence conditioned by karma and delusions, or karma and afflictions. So at the root of our conditioned existence are the causes, which are the karma and the afflictions. And karma here refers to an action, an individual's act, whether positive or negative. So when we speak of action, a human or a sentient being's action, it automatically implies an agency, a motive behind, an intention. So the act themselves are again not the primary cause. The primary cause again is what lays behind, what motivates them, what propels these actions. So here we're talking about intentions, the world of intentions, the world of thoughts and emotions. So underlying many of our karma, particularly the negative ones, are a lot of afflicted states of mind. So ultimately, what we arrive at the root of our suffering, really is these afflictions, afflictive thoughts and emotions. And so in Buddhism, they are called nyunmon or klesha. And the very etymology of klesha suggests that they are states of mind whose very occurrence brings about a disturbance within the individual. And these are the ones that defile one's thoughts and emotions, one afflicts the individual from within. And it is those afflictions which lie at the root of our suffering, and it is those afflictions that needed to be eliminated by applying their direct antidotes. Now the question is, how does the antidotes work when countering these afflictions? So here, these afflictions do not go away simply by making prayers, saying prayers, or wishing them away. These afflictions needed to be eliminated by cultivating their corresponding remedies or antidotes. And how does this antidote, this process of applying the antidote work? Here, you can observe the physical world. For example, in the physical world, you have we can contrast, say, hot heat and coldness in temperature. And if you are suffering from too much heat, by increasing the coolness of the temperature, you can counter that, you can bring that down. And if you are suffering from the effects of a too cold temperature, then you increase the thermometer and adjust it so that you counter it. So even in the physical world, you can see instances where opposing forces counter each other. Similarly, we can take another metaphor of, light and darkness. They oppose each other. The moment you switch on the light, the darkness is dispelled. When there is darkness, there is no light. So there is a kind of an instantaneous relation, kind of a dichotomy between the two. So, however, in the world of internal emotions and thoughts, the process in which antidotes work against its opposing forces is slightly different. Here, we need to cultivate, in order to counteract something, we need to cultivate the right state of mind which directly opposes that particular affliction. Where the way in which it does is by focusing on the same object, but by cultivating directly opposite way of engaging with it. For example, you have hatred and you have compassion or love. In the case of hatred and compassion, there are two different emotions, but they can be focused at a single object, an individual or a being, and then based on that, when you experience hatred or anger, you have kind of a very hostile experience or hostile feeling or attitude towards that object. On the other hand, if you have compassion towards that particular object, it's the same object, but your attitude and your feeling towards that object is of a different kind. Phenomenological experiences of a different kind. And in fact, one could say that by reinforcing one side, you can automatically and naturally and decrease the force of the other. For example, for the sake of argument, say there is an individual who wishes to, who dislikes compassion, who wishes to decrease whatever remnants of compassion there might be in him or her, then in such a case, the individual can most effectively do this by deliberately cultivating hostile attitude towards the object and try to cultivate and try to see the downside of cultivating compassion, try to see the disadvantages of, you know, cultivating loving kindness and so on. And through this way, one could envision that the anger and the hatred can be increased. However, for a spiritual practitioner, that is not the goal, because anger brings the individual harm, it brings disturbance, it brings affliction. Therefore, from a spiritual perspective of a spiritual practitioner, anger and hatred are something that needs to be dispelled, that needs to be relinquished. While compassion and loving kindness is something that needs to be deliberately cultivated, because it brings peace and it brings benefit and help. So this is how the antidotes work in decreasing and eventually eliminating the opposing forces.
Yeah. That.
This is how, when we speak of practicing the teachings of the Buddha, when we speak of engaging in the Dhamma practice, and what is the actual process, the dynamic in which the practice of Dharma works in countering our negative emotions and thoughts. This is how it is, where by deliberately cultivating the corresponding antidote to the negative emotions and thoughts.
Lulu, you are teaching to Timu Kun and Nagy days. Teaching your mother, Timu Jump, the Jumper Jules and Sunday. That 다 둘러 오면 이제 시기 하마다 다 둘러 오면 시주를 시작 서로 심벌 차로 심벌이 자다 안다 우모 시제가 겁니다 어 대송이야 되게 너무 카마 강이 나야 탐자 놀이야 인 뒤목 켜도 야레스 변화 류지지 공부지 미국 공부를 써봐도 이디 콜콜다 장점으로 잘 되게 하래 미국 공부지 나 공부를 켜도 해서 좀 해버려 이나야 류지 공부지 아니 미국 공부를 써봐 공부 신다 탐자 놀이 켜도 야레스 뒤는 신체니 아니 뒤목도 니모 탐자 켜도 야레스 근데 이제 인류 뒤목 녀모 녀모도 좀 더나 아니 녀모시나 되게 아니 뭐 다 르밀밀밀게니 다 내가 차도 그랬으니 다 뒤숭비하래 我就想说，这人民币引入，长发达，控制你不得，那个经济上面的钱，技术创新、技术上头的啊，这差的要的，人民币呢，新钞票嘛，当然物价上涨不一样，控制的，早晚的，对木电子的电器，对木电子时代的，技术老了些，没是控制过一个技术老了，才过了，但对木电子时代的，技术老，你把技术老的产，赚点个，技术老了，老是差的要的，就像个电子什么样嘛的，我没有你做了啊，我技术老不进的要的，他提懂的，那就控制懂的，钱包是那么多，没些样是他，你那个钱包里啊，电子多少块没得哇，电子的，电子的，来不进的，反正用的用，超过没得的，你那块的人心的。 电金买呢，差不多买下，这个是大银的买的，是吧？上面看了，你是有的，就顶住的那个是的，你得点把香槟的，你把多少月过来，这个是要买的。矿主了呀，看了没呢？矿主啥时候有的？点把那呢？点把那呢？点把那是香槟的，你把都搞不下来。地拖钱的矿主就要了嘛，地拖嘛就要矿主家买了的。这地里面有的货，有人不抢呢，抢买了的，几十老个落。 电信给抓买了，电抓少了，但电信买了钱呢，或者让个熟点的配套下去。第一档的矿主的，人家不是电信给抓起来嘛，都买不起。电信现在的，我说全部下来的，伊那样，我进去捞了钱。第一档的，第一个，这个大家伙，看不得了的，人当电话一定给，大米都不晓得的，我有那时候打电话，我有那时候落地去的送人，我有那时候来拿电话。第二个家庭什么有的？
所以，真正因为印度，当真正的概念，你们的，你们的当代罗尼布的，现代人不接轨到了，这个的，恐怕他们都偏了的，这个都恐怕他们都偏了的吧？这的确是重要的。So, one can ask the question that if, in the case of two opposing states of mind and two opposing emotions, such as hatred on the one hand and compassion on the other, if it is the case that by reinforcing one automatically diminishes the force of the other, then the question can be raised, does that mean that there is total symmetry between the two, that there is total equality, absolute equality, that there is no difference at all by, you know, reinforcing hatred, one can completely eliminate compassion, and by reinforcing compassion one can eliminate hatred. If that is the case, is there no difference between the two? Here, it is important to have a deeper understanding of the contrast between positive emotions like compassion and loving kindness on the one hand, and negative emotions like hatred and anger and attachment and so on the other. Generally speaking, if you look at the Buddhist understanding of what is meant by klesha, afflictions, broadly speaking, we observe two general categories of afflictions. You have, on the one side, there are afflictions which tend to be instinctual, such as attachment, such as anger, such as hostility. These are, although in certain circumstances there might be some immediate catalyst, which may, where reason may, some kind of projection and reason may play a role, but generally these emotions are more reactive, more instinctual and impulsive. So that's one category of emotions which are more impulsive and instinctual. Then there are there is another category of emotions which tend to be much more cognitive. Here you have the false view of a sense of selfhood, and also the false view of grasping certain extremist views as being authentic or valid. So these are although afflictions, but they are more cognitive, they are more in the category of the intellect. And in fact, this second category of afflictions are sometimes referred to also as afflicted intelligence, because they have a much greater role of reasoning involved in them. So this is generally the Buddha's understanding of two broad classes of afflictions. However, if you look at deeper, you will understand that if you look at the nature of these emotions, the gross levels of emotions such as extreme hostility and anger and so on, they, at the root of them, is a subtler emotion, which is the delusion, and particularly the delusory mind grasping at some kind of real existence of things. And here we find a deeper understanding of the nature of these afflictions in the Madhyamaka writings. For example, in the 400 verses on the middle way, we find the passage where the author states that just as the bodily faculty permeates all the other sensory faculties, in the same way, delusion underpins all afflictions. So the point being made here is that when you examine carefully experience of a strong affliction like anger or attachment, you will see that underlying it is a cause which is some kind of grasping onto a particular object, whether it be deemed desirable or whether it be deemed undesirable, and depending upon how you perceive that, then it gives rise to an emotional response or reaction. So at the gross level, delusion serves as a cause for the occurrence of these afflictions. However, at the subtle level, in fact, the author of the 400 verses suggests that, in fact, delusions are delusions exist as a kind of a coexist. Delusions coexist with the afflictions themselves, just as the body organ permeates all the sensory faculties. In the same way, this delusion grasping at true existence of things really underpins all the afflictions. So, and in fact, one can say that the afflictions, the arising of afflictions, are dependent upon this grasping at true existence of things. So this delusory mind grasping onto the true existence of things is, in fact, it's distorted, because the real nature of things is emptiness. However, this delusory mind grasps onto them as having some kind of real existence or true existence. In contrast, if you look at a positive emotion like loving kindness, although there are cases where delusory grasping onto an object as true existence may give rise to or support loving compassion, but the arising of loving compassion is not dependent upon grasping onto the object as having some kind of true existence. In fact, loving kindness is an emotion that can be developed to an infinite potential, whereas negative emotions like anger and hatred, because their underlying root is a distorted state of mind, they do not have any valid support or any valid ground in both reason and reality. So and because of this, by cultivating direct insight into the true nature of things, which is emptiness, one will be able to penetrate through the delusion of this misunderstanding of reality as having some kind of true existence. And through this way, one can eventually eliminate, undercut the very basis of the arising of these afflictions. So certainly there is a vast difference between positive emotions like loving kindness and compassion on the one hand, and negative emotions like anger, hatred and attachment on the other, in terms of their sustainability and also in terms of their potential for infinite development. So the question is, if underlying all the afflictions is this delusion, which really underpins them, how do we, on what grounds do we understand this delusion to be this grasping at the true existence of things? Here we go back to the 400 verses on the middle way, where immediately after the verse that I cited, Aryadeva writes that it is by gaining insight into the truth of the dependent origination, one will bring about the cessation of delusion. So the point being made here is that he is saying that when the individual develops a deep insight into the subtle aspects of the teachings on dependent origination, then he or she will bring about the cessation of the delusion. So here, the delusion is being identified or defined as a misconception or a state of mind which perceives the world and the self in contrary to the principle of dependent origination. And because according to the principle of dependent origination, all things come into being as a result of a dependence upon other factors. And it's the opposite of that would be to accord status of independence and independent existence to things and events. Because if things possess independent status, if things possess independent existence, then of course they cannot have the nature of dependence upon others. And this status, this projected status of independence is what is being referred to as self in the context of the teaching on selflessness. And so the teaching on, by teaching selflessness, what is being taught is the absence of the independent existence of things, because all things come into being as a result of depending upon other causes and conditions, or other factors, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
So the Aryadeva concludes by saying that whatever is dependently originating. Aryadeva concludes by saying that that which is dependently originated cannot possess the nature of independence, and this absence of independent existence is what I called dependent origination. As to whether or not this delusion, grasping on to things and events as possessing true existence, whether or not this is considered to be a defilement of the category of afflictions or subtle objects, subtle obstructions to knowledge, among the Nagarjuna's disciples, there is a divergence of opinion on this. On the one hand are such commentators of Nagarjuna like Bhava Viveka, who understood this delusion, this grasping at true existence of things to be a subtle obstruction to knowledge rather than a defilement of affliction, while based upon Nagarjuna's own 70 stanzas on the middle way, there were other commentators of Nagarjuna who maintained that it is actually part of the afflictions, afflicted states of mind. And they argued that even to attain the state of arhathood, which is freedom from samsara, cyclic existence, one needs to eliminate this grasping at true existence. And it is on the basis of that understanding then the assertion is made that the insight into emptiness is the sole path to liberation. There is no second path other than second path or second door other than the wisdom of no self, wisdom of selflessness. And the wisdom of selflessness or no self is understood in terms of what is called the three doors to liberation, or three doors to thorough liberation, where the the insight into the emptiness of things and events is cultivated on the basis of understanding its nature, from the point of view of its causes, and from the point of view of its effects as well.
When speaking about this teaching on the no self and understanding of the selflessness, here we need to relate back to the teachings on the Four Noble Truths in the first public sermon that the Buddha gave. When the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, he taught them in terms of 16 characteristics of the Four Noble Truths, four in relation to each. And the four characteristics of the first noble truth, the suffering, are impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and emptiness, and no self. So, and so all the different schools of Buddhism, all the followers of the Buddha, in one way or another, understand the key teaching of the Buddha to be embodied in this teaching on no self or anatman, no self or absence of selfhood. Of course, there are divergence of interpretations as to what that no self means. In fact, if you look at the history of philosophical thought in India, we see a very long tradition of analysis on this nature of selfhood, nature of the individual, nature of being. The fact that you know, when we experience pain and pleasure, there is the question of who is it that experiences it? Who is it that undergoes that experience? When we speak of accumulating karma, who is it that accumulates the karma? Who is the agent of the karmic act? When we speak of experiencing the fruits of one's karma, again the question is, who is it that experiences the fruits of karma? The fact that there is an individual, there is a being that we label as I am, is something that is commonly accepted. But the question is, what exactly is the nature of that self? What exactly is the nature of that being? Here we see a very long tradition in ancient India in the analysis of what that nature is, nature of the being or the person is. On the whole, among the non-Buddhist schools in India, especially those schools which accept the idea of rebirth, on the whole, there was a kind of a convergence of opinion that since physical body is contingent upon a particular life, and it's transient, when the life ceases, a particular life ceases, the physical body of that individual being also comes to an end. Therefore, self cannot be identified with the body, bodily existence. And therefore, on the whole, the non-Buddhist schools maintain that the self must be something that is completely independent of the physical and psychological constituents that make up that individual's existence. There must be a self, there must be an eternal principle that is enduring and that transcends individual life cycles, that maintain its continuum in an eternal temporal stages. And whether or not they will characterize it as eternal, unchanging and unitary, but in the belief in this kind of self or Atman, if you probe deeper, these three key characteristics are thought to be the main characteristics of this self, that it is, temporally speaking, eternal, that it is unitary, indivisible, and that it is independent, or in some sense self-governing. And this is what is called the Atman, the self. And on the whole, all Buddhist schools reject that kind of notion of selfhood, that kind of notion of eternal self. However, within Buddhism, the schools have divergent opinion as to if that kind of self cannot be posited, then how do we understand the notion of person? How do we understand the agency? Who is it, that being? Here, among the Buddhist schools, and there are some schools who try to identify the person or the self on the basis of the physical and the mental aggregates that make up the individual. For example, some schools maintain that it's the totality of the five skandhas that is the being, that is the self, or that is the person. Others maintain that it is on the basis of the continuum of consciousness that one must posit the individual being or the person. And there are others like the mind-only school which maintain that the followers of the scripture of the Yogacara, the mind-only school, where they maintain that it is not just the mental consciousness, but rather there is a unique continuum of consciousness called the foundational consciousness, which really is must be identified as the person. Then there are those, the followers of Nagarjuna, particularly those who understand it to be Nagarjuna's ultimate standpoint, they maintain that any attempt to identify self as something that is independent of the body and mind is untenable. Then the question is, how do you explain the relationship between the self and the transient body and mind? So that is untenable. Equally untenable is the attempt to identify self within the body and mind. The followers of Nagarjuna, particularly those who take the Nagarjuna's subtle view, they maintain that both these dichotomies, identifying self as independent of the body and mind, and identifying the self to be either one of the aggregates of the either the body or mind, that is also problematic. So the self or the person must be understood only as a kind of a label, an appellation, a designation that is given on the basis of the aggregation of the mind and body. And so we must understand the nature of self or the person to be mere designation, something that is that has no absolute or intrinsic reality.
nyumon pangme trewe yöndenji, da, kasukuru tupungi bichi, lole chi, le yöndi, ene taba seyaji, ngotwe yaji da, taba tuni ngoloji, le yaji duwa. Le yaji yasari.
So, if we observe things and events sort of more deeply, we will recognize that all things and events really come about as a result of aggregation of many factors. They are dependent upon many factors for their existence, that none of them enjoy any independent existence, that that all things and events, their ultimate nature is mere dependence upon other factors. However, when we perceive them, when we observe them, somehow we tend to get the impression that they possess some kind of discrete, independent realities of their own. We do not perceive things and events to be in this kind of interconnected, dependently originating reality. We tend to see them as each having its own independent, discretely identifiable kind of units. So what we see here is a gulf between the way things really are and the way we perceive them. And it is this disparity between our perception of the world and the reality of things that really underpins the various afflictive and emotional responses that we have in our dealing with the world. So, therefore, this suggests that the basis, the root of many of the afflictions such as anger, hatred, attachment, and so on, is a distorted state of mind. It's a distorted understanding of the world. And so the first, the root of the afflictions is this distorted state of mind. Secondly, and this understanding of this perception of world as having some kind of independent reality is groundless. It has no valid grounding. And thirdly, when one cultivates the direct antidote, which is the wisdom of no self, then this wisdom of no self will directly counter this misconception of the world as having some kind of true and independent existence. So when you compare the two, this false view of the world opposed to the insight into no self, one has a very valid grounding in both experience and reason, the other lacks valid grounding in both reason and experience. So because of this, when you compare the two and let them compete with each other, obviously the force that has valid grounding and experience and reality will as a result of cultivating it, as a result of developing it and reinforcing it, eventually you will get to a point where one will be able to totally eliminate this false view of the world. And furthermore, this insight into the no self, the wisdom of no self, because it is a quality of mind, its basis is very enduring. It's not a characteristic like a bodily quality whose basis is limited, whereas it's a mental quality whose basis is very enduring in terms of its continuum. Therefore, another characteristic of the mental quality is that once you cultivate it to a point where it becomes spontaneous, then further development, you do not need to make an extra deliberate conscious effort to bring it to your mind. A simple catalyst or impetus can immediately give rise to that kind of understanding or that kind of mental quality to arise in you. So when you compare all of these points together, then and also when you understand that the afflictions are separable from the essential nature of mind, that they are removable because their basis is is distorted state of mind, and by removing this distorted state of mind, afflictions can be removed. So when you compare all of these points together, then eventually you will get to a point where the word liberation or moksha will really have some profound meaning for you. You will also get a sense that yes, liberation is possible, and this is what is meant by liberation. So when you understand that liberation is possible, then you can extend that and then combine that understanding with the understanding of Buddha nature explained in such as the Tathagata Garbha Sutra that I referred to earlier, where the essential nature of mind is described as luminous, mere luminosity, that it is unpolluted and it's mere luminosity. And so when you understand this, then you will also come to realize that not only are the afflictions removable, but also the propensities and imprints left by these afflictions in us can also be removable. Because if the afflictions themselves can be eliminated, then of course the propensities for these afflictions and also the imprints left by these afflictions can also be eliminated. And through this way you will get an understanding of the possibility of liberation. In this way one also understands the possibility of attaining the Buddhahood, which is the total elimination of including not only the afflictions but also their propensities and imprints. So when we speak of the resultant state of Buddhahood, in the Bodhisattva scriptures, the Mahayana scriptures, the state of Buddhahood is described in terms of the state of the four embodiments of full enlightenment, or the four kayas. And the understanding of the four kayas, the most profound and more detailed understanding of the four kayas, can be developed on the basis of reading and studying the Vajrayana texts, where the understanding of the four kayas is presented on the basis of the subtle mind, the fundamental innate mind of clear light. And here the emptiness of the fundamental innate mind of clear light at the state of Buddhahood, that is described as the Svabhavakaya, the natural embodiment of the Buddha. And the omniscient mind of the Buddha at that state is described as the wisdom Dharmakaya, the wisdom truth body. And and the subtle energy or the prana, which is inseparable from this Buddha's Dharmakaya state, the subtle energy in its most subtle form is explained as the Sambhogakaya, the Buddha body of perfect resource. And when that subtle energy assumes a form that is visible to, that is at the level of more visibility and grosser level, that embodiment of the Buddhahood is described as Nirmanakaya, the Buddha body of perfect emanation. So we can see that in the Vajrayana explanation of the four kayas, explanation is done on the base, all in terms of the understanding of the fundamental innate mind of clear light. So with this,
think along these lines, then we will get a deeper understanding of what is meant by dharma, and on the basis of dharma, how we understand the Buddha, who is the example of the total perfection of that dharma, or total realization of that dharma, and the sangha, which is those who are on the path of realization of that dharma. So this is how, on the basis of the first verse of this text, the verse of salutation to the three jewels, that one can in fact gain a general introduction to what is meant by Buddha Dharma. So it is important for us who consider ourselves as practicing Buddhists to have these understandings, so that when we go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha and recite Buddham Sharanam Gacchami, Dhammam Sharanam Gacchami, Sangham Sharanam Gacchami, I go for refuge to the Buddha, I go for refuge to the Dharma, I go for refuge to the Sangha, so that we know we have a certain understanding of the object of our going for refuge, so that by cultivating a deep admiration, by reflecting upon the qualities of the Buddha, we go for refuge to the Buddha of the past, the historical Buddhas and so on, and also cultivating a deep conviction and faith in their qualities and attainment, one goes for refuge to them. But also it is important to understand that one's going for refuge to the three jewels must be related to one's own inner realizations and experience of the path, so that when you go for refuge in your faith, there is also a faith of emulation. That not only do you have admiration for the three jewels, but also you emulate the examples, so that you aspire for yourself the realization of the three jewels. So derived through such kind of
faith of emulation, and then one engages in the path and cultivates within oneself all the various levels of realizations, and beginning from the minute levels of the path and so on. And then as a result of attaining the true path within oneself, one attains cessations, and which then makes the individual to be a Sangha, Arya Sangha, a noble Sangha. And then as a result of continuing in one's path, when the individual finally culminates in his or her realization, then one attains the state of Buddhahood. So in this way, one should be able to not only understand the act of going for refuge in relation to a historical or past Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, but also to one's own resultant future Buddha, Dharma and Sangha.
Oh yeah. Tadi chuju ki shabadi sumachani. Tadi ne shumishiliya chungunda chaujibi kibu sumdu shabada cha sa. Tadi digi ene tanashi umoju boda mando janda ene zaashirada si dhukudu ne ene lam kurim ma tarja ma danyamne chedam ma dune den shabashi nabare.그림 따차는 르라지 동해 그다음에 가서 다 민남기 집게 런도 다루고 아니 럭체즈체리 코레 양라 차셔로 두부소소스네 내도 눈이 대차스 지게 인 동결윤이 아니 지금 두번이 된게 로베 차오지 용태하지 자 리인베인도 그림 만나와지 계속 처리하래 다 안듯이 남중 걸리야다 그림 만나와지는 거 치단지 다 숨기하래 대인이 그림 직단지 기부 충분 넘는 기부 증근 넘는 기부 치부를 넘는 시에 기부 충지 최소신에 로름지 타송기 다다 로름지 타송기 보다 르브지 감사 소설 계제 말이 냐는 지금 소설 계제 말이 냐는 지금 지 내가 다 보면 내가 로제 충중인데 거두기 르브르지 되네 알로 증두 집에 내가 무슨 말이지 되네 알로 고모 집에 내가 무슨 말이지 어다 대 뜨네 아니 가서다 냐는 시간이 반도스 뒤고도 가 다가다 냐는 지난 걸로 그게다 가소래 야채를다 설류 디디다 되네 디냐네 지금이다 가사를 띄고 중문들 등도 쳐보시네 누구신데 자연이지 인사해 사실 이 인도 안 되디 띄고 가사 중문들도 쳐주고 띄고 숨도 시작을 잘했어 다 좀 된 데기 최 렘랭기 가사리야 아니 로즘지 타마숨기 아니 타마숨 소리다 로즘 다 로 타고베 레타고베 니그지 아니 파르멘 니그지 네 알로베 야 공도 주비 니그지 체니 근데이다 로면도 도치조 숨이 되네 지 인기 우승인 거래겠지 다 근데 인기 우승 대다 체니로서 소소여 주어차스
So having now explained the verse, the stanza, the verse of salutation, then in verse 2, the actual exposition of the teaching begins. Here we read, understand there are three kinds of persons because of their small, middling, and supreme capacities. So what is being presented here and what is unique about this text by Adisha is that here the presentation of the teachings are made in such a way, arranged in such a way that there is a definite sequence to the order of the different topics of the practices, arranged in conformity in relation to the way in which these should be practiced in their proper sequence. For example, in various other Indian treatises such as Nagarjuna's Madhyamaka Mula Karika, the fundamentals of the middle way, and Chandrakirti's supplement to the middle way, Madhyamaka Avatara. In many of these treatises, of course, all the parts have been presented correctly, and also most of the key elements of the path has been presented, of course, with different degrees of emphasis. For example, in Nagarjuna's fundamentals of the middle way, the main emphasis is on the teaching on dependent origination and emptiness and the understanding of emptiness in terms of dependent origination. However, the other aspects of the path are also found presented in them. So what is lacking in these other treatises is that there is the presentation of the teachings is not done with a definite sequence of the practices by actual application in one's practice. And Adisha points out that this is very important for in order to engage into the practice, it is important to have a full understanding of what is the proper sequence in which one should engage in the path. Practice should be undertaken first and what practice should follow this and so on. And he says that without this, then the effectiveness of one's practice may not be very great. For example, let us take the example of, say, the bodhicitta, the altruistic aspiration to attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all beings. It is not simply enough to say that may I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all beings. It is easy to say in words, but when it actually comes to cultivating it, how does one go about cultivating such an altruistic aspiration. Here, until and unless the individual has developed some understanding of what is the object of aspiration, which is the Buddhahood, that the full enlightenment, then it is not possible to really develop this bodhicitta. So some understanding of what is meant by enlightenment is important. And also what is important is to have some deeper understanding of the nature of suffering that you wish others to be free of. And in order to develop this strong compassion, seeking others to be free of other sentient beings to be free of suffering, one must have a deeper understanding of the nature of suffering in relation to one's own personal experience. And on the basis of that personal experience of one's own understanding of suffering, then one will be able to cultivate a strong desire to gain freedom from that, which is the true renunciation. And when these elements are then combined together, then one will be able to give rise to a bodhicitta, which is the altruistic aspiration to attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all beings. So what you see here is that in order for an important aspect of the path like bodhicitta to take root in oneself, one needs to cultivate the different components of it individually first. And when you do that, then eventually you'll be able to cultivate bodhicitta. So there is a kind of a certain order to the actual development of these aspects of the path. And so Adisha in this text explains these various aspects of the path in relation to the actual sequence of individual cultivating these aspects of the path. And here he does so by using the framework of the practitioners of three different capacities. And when we speak of the small capacity, middling capacity, and the supreme capacities, we are not necessarily referring to three completely different individuals, some with the higher capacities and some with middling capacity and some with small or inferior capacities. In fact, what is being referred to here is the different levels of mental state an individual practitioner attains through progressive stages. So at the beginner stage, the individual practitioner can be referred to as one with a small capacity, and as a result of practice, when he or she progresses to the next stage, then he or she is of the middling capacity, and then as he or she further progresses, then reaches the supreme capacity. So these three capacities can be understood in relation to a single practitioner in a progressively evolving stages of mental development. And so he explains that the importance of understanding the proper order of the practices and referring it to the different levels of the mental realizations. So he writes, "I shall write clearly distinguishing their individual characteristics, the characteristics of the three capacities."
Sonam
We can here see a kind of an analogy to even modern education. We can say that there is a kind of a roughly corresponds to the elementary stage of education, elementary school, then the high school and college, where one sort of advances into more specialized areas of study. So these three levels of practices in correspondence to the three capacities can be likened to different stages of schooling. And also we can relate Atisha's teaching on the three scopes, the three capacities, to an earlier demarcation of the three phases of spiritual development found in Aryadeva's 400 verses on the middle way, where he says that at the first stage, one must avert or reverse the unwholesome deeds, and in the middling stage, one must reverse the selfhood, grasping at selfhood, and in the final stage, one must eliminate all wrong views, all views, or one must dismantle all the views. So this can be related to Atisha's presentation of the three scopes, because when we say unwholesome deeds, here we are talking about negative actions and thoughts, which are the main causes of our suffering. And so when we speak about the causes of suffering, of course here we're talking about karma or actions, and within the karma generally we make distinctions between three types of karma. One is the negative karma, unwholesome karma. Then you have what is called the wholesome karma, or the meritorious karma or actions, and then there is what is called the immutable karma or unchangeable karma. And the first karma, the negative karma, give rise to sufferings in the lower realms, and it is the meritorious karma that gives rise to birth in the higher realms, and as a human and celestial beings. And it is the immutable or unchangeable karma that gives birth in the form and formless realms. So we can say that Aryadeva's first stage, where the practitioner is advised to reverse or eliminate the negative karma, relates to corresponds to Atisha's the initial scope, or the small capacity practice, where the main objective is to gain freedom from immediate experiences of suffering, the obvious sufferings of the lower realms, where the spiritual quest is motivated by a kind of a fear of undergoing experience of suffering in the lower realms. So motivated by that fear, then you seek freedom from that. And here, the main practice is really embodied in the practice of morality, of abstaining from the 10 negative actions of body, speech, and mind, and which is the precept of the actual practice of going for refuge. The precept for going for refuge is to live one's life in accordance with the ethical discipline of refraining from the 10 negative actions by consciously adopting a kind of a ethical discipline by refraining from these. And this is the main, this is the actual practice of the initial scope, and which corresponds to the first phase of the practice as referred to in Aryadeva's 400 verses. And then the second line in Aryadeva's text, which says that in the middle, selfhood must be eliminated or averted. This again corresponds to Atisha's second middling scope, because the main motivation or aspiration of the practitioner of the middling scope is to gain freedom from cyclic existence. And here, the actual practice would be to try to eliminate the afflictions which give rise to the experience of cyclic existence. So, and then finally, the third line of Aryadeva's text, where he says, finally, all views must be dismantled. And this corresponds to Atisha's third scope, that's the supreme scope, where the motivation is not only to gain freedom from secular existence, but also gain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings and bring about the cessation of suffering of all sentient beings. And so we can see that if we are to use the analogy of say a combat, in fact one can say that the practice of Dharma is engaging in combat with our inner enemy, the afflictions. And so when waging a war against afflictions, first stage is to really ensure that you have a very good defense, so that you are secure, you are not vulnerable to the attacks of the afflictions. And in order to do that, you need to build a defense. And this defense is built by trying to overcome the manifestations of these afflictions in bodily and verbal actions and thoughts. In other words, by adopting this ethical discipline of refraining from the 10 negative actions of body, speech and mind, thus ensuring a security of the practitioner. And then once you have gained confidence in having a secure defense that you are not vulnerable to the attacks from the afflictions, then on the next stage, then you take on the afflictions head on directly. You can counter them directly and combat with it, because you are now assured of your own defense. And then finally, not only must the enemy be defeated, the afflictions be eliminated, but also one must ensure that not even traces are left. In other words, not even the propensities of these afflictions are left in one's mental continuum. So this is the third phase of the spiritual practice, as mentioned by Aryadeva, which also corresponds to Atisha's third scope. We can also understand this process of the development in terms of the three different levels of Atisha's explanation of the three scopes, or Aryadeva's three phases of realization or practice, from another perspective, from the perspective of our object of aspiration. What we as practitioners aspire is the attainment of higher rebirths as a temporary objective, and our ultimate objective is to attain liberation from cyclic existence and the omniscient state of Buddhahood. So the practice of the initial scope, where the key practice is really embodied in the ethical discipline of refraining from 10 negative actions of body, speech and mind, is really the key practice that ensures the fulfillment of that temporary objective, which is the attainment of rebirth in higher realms, such as human and celestial existence. And here, as Nagarjuna points out in his precious garland, that for the spiritual practitioners, there are two primary objectives. Well, the temporary one is the birth in the higher realms, and the ultimate is the definite goodness, which he calls definite goodness. And in terms of the factors that give rise to these achievements, faith is primary for the attainment of higher rebirths, and wisdom is primary for attainment of definite goodness. So definite goodness here refers to the liberation from cyclic existence and also the Buddhahood, the full enlightenment of the Buddhahood. So when we speak of the second scope and the third scope obviously relates to our quest for attainment of this definite goodness. And when we speak of faith in the Buddhist context, although generally speaking there are many different kinds of faith, but in the Buddhist context, when we speak of faith, the faith is something that must be understood where faith that is reinforced by wisdom or intelligence. And in fact, it is important to have a faith grounded in reason and also, or wisdom, and also wisdom reinforced by faith and compassion. So there should be a kind of a mutual complementarity between the skillful means aspect of the path and also wisdom aspect of the path, so that one reinforces and complements the other.
Janita, ngondo ngondu digi tuyagi chogordi kibuchumulamche. Ta ngeleliya ni shani nyomo sampangbe tabachita shiru chiba pangbe tabachik shani ngeli chik shani ta ngeli ni yebe nane ta tabasam dhruvichiri sambe chogodi kibuchumulamche. Ta ngeli tamche chiba tuyagi chogodi kibuchumulamche. Shinde ta dila kansa yu tadeba kibuchumulam rangzabala lamechi. Tene kibuchumulam rangzabala ngondu dhruya tane kibuchumulam lamechi rangzabachi yangyache. Ta anda di lamchung kamne sunya di tegyanda chushu kudu ne tekshin ki chushu kunjo, tekshin ki nukunjo shani anda shu daya digi anda kamdir namchin dhruya agi kibuchumulam lamechi sunga yoche. Kibuchumbe lamme sungbe kadoliya, kibu chungudu tumuwe lamlimdi, tumungdu, tumungu chöshinbe yinza, kibu chumbe lamlabge tegyang, kibu chungdengi lamdi mara labgubiyari. Kibu chumbe lam rangzabana dhubiyamari, kibu chungdengi lamda tumuwe minnamdi yidi jangche. Chasangata, kibu chumbe lamlabge tegye, yinza chungudu tumuwe lamlim, dhingdu tumuwe lamlim, dhanam rimbashin dhulwa jangde, yinza tadu kibu chumbe lamlabge jangwaya deyipari.
So we can summarize by saying that the practices that are associated with the quest for attaining a higher rebirth, and those practices are practices of the initial scope, practitioners of the initial scope or initial capacity. And within the definite goodness, there are two levels. One is the liberation from cyclic existence, where the liberation is constituted by elimination of the afflictions or cessation of the afflictions. Then there is also the ultimate attainment of full enlightenment, where it is defined as a state where not only the afflictions have been eliminated, but also their propensities and imprints as well. So all the practices that are associated with the attainment of liberation from cyclic existence, they belong to the middling capacity or middling scope, and all the practices that are associated with the attainment of the omniscient state of Buddhahood, those belong to the supreme capacity or great scope. And so although one can imagine that there could be three completely different individuals, each following these practices of these different capacities. For example, there could be an individual practitioner whose wish is to only pursue the practice associated only with the initial scope. However, in the text here, in Atisha's text, when he speaks of the three scopes or three capacities, he's talking primarily of an individual who goes through these in a progressively evolving stages, where because the ultimate purpose of the practitioner of this text is someone who is seeking the attainment of full enlightenment. So the presentation is made from the point of view of someone who goes through all these three different stages of capacity in a progressive stages. And so the point is that even for the practitioners of the middling capacity and the supreme capacities, they must first undertake the practice of the initial scope. So there is a definite sequence, so that the practices of the former scope is common to the practices of the latter scope, so that the initial scope practices are common to the practices of the middling scope, and the practices of the middling scope is a common practice for the practitioners of the great scope, and so on. So we will stop here today.
Changeau